Seeing Japan, the podcast where we explore the land of evil acts. I'm Demon Paul.
And I'm Demon Jason. And I'm starting to question whether these voices are appropriate given the subject matter of this episode, because it's pretty serious and really dark and like, I don't know. What do you think, Demon Paul?
That's too deep for a demon, bro.
I think the demon actually is a good way to shield me psychologically from the reality of these awful things we're about to talk about.
That's a good way to look at it. Yeah. Well, we're talking about some pretty messed up stuff today.
Yes? Before we get anywhere.
Well, Yeah.
Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
Yes, yes, yes. Halloween special.
I also wanted to say, Paul, did you realize this is the last episode that will be released before our meetup in Tokyo?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Our meetup's in just a few days, everybody. I want to make sure to take this last chance to mention that on November 6th, 2024, at 7 p.m., we're going to be at a bar called Commune on the rooftop of the Shibuya Parco shopping mall in Tokyo. The details are in the show notes. And I mean, it's probably too late. I don't know. This is just a reminder, I guess, to
yeah.
the people that...
That's Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be fun. If you're in Tokyo, I hope you come out and say hi.
Yeah, so we'll be in Japan when this airs, but obviously we haven't left yet.
Yeah.
Are you fully prepared, Jason?
I mean, I haven't packed yet, if that's what you're asking.
Okay, I assumed that you hadn't done that.
I'm still working on figuring out what's wrong with my foot before my long hike through the mountains. But for the most part, yeah, I'm feeling pretty prepared.
Okay.
You?
I'm feeling pretty good, but I'm not 100% prepared. Like, I haven't figured out internet yet. I'm pretty sure I'm just going to get the international plan on my phone again. Even though it was a little pricey, it worked really well for me.
Yeah.
So I'm planning to just do that. I haven't done that yet.
I haven't figured out internet stuff either. I actually bought a new phone.
I was wondering what you were going to do because it didn't work so well for you last time.
Right. It was horrible last time. And I'm not sure if it was the phone or the network I was on or what.
Yeah, because we were on different networks and mine was working and yours wasn't.
But I ordered the new iPhone. I'm hoping that it'll get here before we leave, and then I'm hoping that that new phone will make things work better, because my plan already includes internet, so like I should just show up, and it should work, and everything will be fine. That's best case scenario. Worst case, I might use Ubigi or something to get an eSIM. That's my backup plan.
Okay.
But I'm just going to see what happens, you know?
Fair enough.
Yeah.
I could do a little more research about possible restaurants to eat at and a few things like that. But I'm feeling pretty good.
There was a sushi place that I wanted to book a meal at, but I can't do that for a few more days.
Ah, yeah, yeah.
And then we also need to get our tickets to get to Kamikochi.
Oh, yeah, didn't we have to wait to within 90 or 30 days, I think?
Yep.
So we're...
A few more days.
Close, we're almost there. Yeah, we're almost
there. I have the dates all written down. I got it in my to-do list.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah. But anyway, it's also Halloween season. How's your Halloween season going? You done any Halloween-y stuff? It doesn't really feel like it yet because it's so warm.
Well, I mean, we just did Renaissance Festival last weekend, and I dressed up in a costume, so it almost felt Halloween-y.
Yeah.
We both had cool costumes this year.
That was fun.
Yeah.
I'm excited for that to be a part of our tradition.
I feel like almost more people than not are wearing a costume there.
There were a lot. Yeah,
like I felt like I was in, you know, rather than the no fun guy. I was finally not the no fun guy this year.
Yeah, it was good vibes.
Yeah, that was fun. But otherwise, I haven't thought too much because we're going to be in Japan for Halloween, so I haven't.
I really wonder what's going to be going on in Takayama for Halloween.
I haven't looked into it yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if not much. But maybe in that little downtown area, there might be some fun going on.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, can we start making our way towards the topic today?
Yeah, if there hasn't been fair warning enough, let me spell it out very clearly. Warning, viewer discretion advised. There are going to be the worst things imaginable we're going to talk about.
Yeah, this is not for children. This is not for people who are not interested in hearing like really graphic details of some extremely disturbing crimes. Is that enough?
I think it should be.
Okay.
Doing this research was interesting because I can't say I really liked all of it, but it was like, you know how you watch a train wreck and you can't take your eyes away?
Right.
That was kind of like reading about these things. Like, I was horrified, but it was like, why did he do it?
Yeah.
What was his punishment? I just like kind of kept going.
Right. I want to come back to that, but just real quick, I wanted to mention like all of our Halloween specials in the past have been kind of like fun, creepy, spooky stuff, you know? And I feel like Halloween as a whole, that's kind of the vibe is, I mean, horror movies and stuff maybe are a part of it, but it's more like the fun, entertaining, you know, oh, it's fun to be scared, that kind of stuff. And as I was researching this, I started thinking like, is this Halloween-y stuff? Or is it like too real to be, did you get where I'm going?
Yeah. It's not entirely Halloween-y, no. Because Halloween-y is always like a little bit campy. This is real.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
It's true crime, which is popular. I mean, is what it is.
Yeah.
So the horror theme ties in.
Yes, but...
Don't worry. If you hate this, it was Jason's idea.
It was. I'll take the blame.
But I bet a lot of people are going to like it. These cases are popular for a reason. All these cases are famous.
I enjoy true crime. There was a time in my life when I was able to listen to podcasts a lot, and I listened to a lot of true crime podcasts. Paul, what's your experience with true crime media? Are you into it? Have you consumed much of it?
When I was young and my parents had cable, I would watch like the campy, you know, murder mystery shows. That's about as deep as I've ever got.
Okay. Well, I got to admit, I've always been kind of fascinated by this kind of stuff. I think even on the podcast, you've spilled the beans before and said that I was like weirdly into serial killers and whatever when I was a little kid. But
yeah, I said like that was most of your bookshelf and you were like, no, a quarter at most.
Something like that. But, and maybe this is just me trying to sound more like an intellectual or something, but I like to think that it's not entertaining to me as much as it is just really interesting because like the reason I was into learning about serial killers is because I want to understand the minds of the people that do these things. Like it's so far outside of, you know, my life experience and most people's life experience. Like it's so extreme. It's hard to even understand how a person could be in that place psychologically where that would be in the realm of possibility, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, like, I just, while I'm alive, I want to know as much as I can, including, like, the extremes of human experience.
Agreed. This isn't something I dive into that often, but occasionally, like, it's part of what humans do, and we shouldn't hide from it or shy away from it. We shouldn't revel in it or maybe, like, do this every day, but it's an interesting topic to look into occasionally.
Yeah, like I just wanted to understand it, you know, and I've watched the serial killer documentaries and stuff, and I got to say, I don't really feel like I'm that much closer to understanding, you know, which is...
I mean, can you though?
I don't know. Like you can even hear these people talk about horrible things that they've done, and it's like, I just don't get it. Like I have so many more questions, and they never seem to ask the questions that I want to ask in those documentaries. I don't know. The closest I can get, like with the serial killer specifically, is that it seems like they have this urge that they just can't ignore, you know? It's like this drive and they become obsessed with it. And it's like, until I kill somebody, this is just going to be festering in my brain forever. You know what I mean?
Yeah. My theory, completely unscientifically, is that a lot of these people are coming from places of self-hatred. Like hating yourself makes you lash out. And that's why they're lashing out so incredibly violently is because they're extremely uncomfortable with themselves for some reason.
That's interesting. I remember actually you lent me a book once. I think it was called Violence, an American Epidemic, something like that.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the thesis of this book was that, you know, these people that are really scary because they've done just horrible things, it's like they're using that as a way to protect themselves, you know, to make people afraid of them rather than pity them or look down on them.
Right. Right. When I see someone being like overly violent, I do kind of pity them. I'm like, you can't handle your own emotions for some reason. That must suck.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah, I've always found true crime really interesting, but what I really don't like about some true crime shows and podcasts out there is when it's like super sensationalized and they like, you know, use all this creepy music and like they start talking in low creepy voices and it's just like, come on, like I don't need that. Just give me the facts. I don't need you to tell me how to feel about this or be like, oh, this person's a monster, aren't they? Oh,
and that's when he met her in the back alley and there's like a sound effect of a woman screaming in the background or something.
Yeah, like, I don't like that. And I, you know, researching this episode and thinking about how we were going to do this, I want to be respectful and tactful about how we discuss this stuff.
I actually don't know how this is going to go because some of the stuff I have in my notes, I'm not sure if I'm even going to be comfortable saying
into
a microphone. Like, I'm not sure. We'll see what happens here.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. It's awful stuff that we're going to be talking about.
We've successfully psyched everyone up for this episode.
Yeah. Oh, well, another thing I wanted to say in the intro is we have to remember that Japan is statistically one of the safest countries in the world, right? So these stories, as horrific as they are, should in no way discourage anyone from visiting Japan. But human beings are human beings, and sometimes they do really awful things.
Japan being such a safe country is part of what makes all these crimes so shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Jason, we're going to start today with the case of Junko Furuta.
Yes.
She was a bright, popular, friendly 17-year-old high school student in 1988.
She lived in Misato, which is a city in Saitama Prefecture, basically just a bit northeast from central Tokyo. It's like a 30-minute train ride from central Tokyo. And on November 25th, 1988, Junko was biking home from her part-time job when a boy around her age came up and kicked her off of her bike and ran away. And then another boy came up who saw this happen, and he, you know, said, hey, that was pretty crappy of that guy. Let me walk you home. But what she didn't know was that these two boys were actually working together, weren't they, Paul?
Yeah, they were.
I heard that they had both dropped out of school recently, and supposedly some accounts say that they had gotten involved with the Yakuza.
Yep.
Now, there seems to be a lot of debate on that point. Like whether or not they were actually affiliated with the Yakuza. It seems like maybe they were just kind of wannabe gangsters, or if they were Yakuza, they were like the very lowest level, like people just kind of trying to get close to the...
They were telling everybody they were involved with the Yakuza, but I don't know if there's any firm evidence they were.
Yeah, they might have just been trying to scare people.
But they could have been used as low-level, do-this-thing-no-one-else-wants-to-do type guys, too.
Perhaps.
But these boys were also former classmates of Junko's before they dropped out. And there were a lot of reports that one of them had asked her out in the past, and she turned them down. But it, one says it was this boy, one says it was the other boy. Nothing seems to agree on that.
Yeah, well, let's take a second here to just point out that like with all of these things that we're talking about, it's hard to get solid details. Like if you look up these stories in different places, you'll get all these different details that might be contradictory, or one says that a lot more happened than this other one. It's hard to know exactly which of these details is true, because like some articles seem to say these were definitely Yakuza, and then other ones are like, oh, they were just wannabes.
Yeah, I don't know how court records go in Japan and what's public record and what's not. Also, the victim is underage.
Right. Well,
and the perpetrators are underage, so a lot of things are sealed and redacted.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for most of these, we shouldn't even know the names of the people that committed these crimes. It's just that the media like eventually leaked their name accidentally, or somebody figured out somehow who they were.
Yeah.
But like most of these were, they just call people like Boy A, things like that.
Yes.
Anyway, back to the story. Where were we?
We
were talking about this, how they were maybe Yakuza.
Yeah.
Okay, so the boy who kicked Junko off her bike, his name was Shinji Minato. He was 16 at the time. And the boy who offered to walk her home was Hiroshi Miyano. He was 18, and he was apparently the ringleader of this little gang or whatever, this group of boys, right? There were also two other gang members who will show up soon, Joe Ogura, who was 17, and Yasushi Watanabe, who was also 17. So as we said, Miyano, he's acting all sympathetic, walking her home. But instead of actually walking her home, what he did was he brought her to a warehouse where he threatened her, telling her he was a Yakuza member and that she had to follow his orders or he would hurt her.
He then raped her.
Well, he brought her to a hotel, right? He forced her to follow him to a hotel.
I heard that he possibly raped her at the warehouse, then brought her to a hotel and raped her again.
Okay.
And then at the hotel, he called up his buddies, Joe Ogura and Yasushi Watanabe, and bragged about what he had just done. And Ogura told him, no, you got to keep her so that we can all rape her too. So then later that night, he brought her to a park nearby where they all met up and gang raped her.
And they continued to threaten her. They said that they knew where she lived and that they would kill her family if she tried to escape. Then they brought Junko to a room on the second floor of Minato's house, where she was then held captive and brutally tortured for the next 39 days.
Yes, it's disgusting, the things they did to her. It's unbelievable.
It is. Like, it is right on the border of what's believable, you know? When we start talking about the things that they actually did to her, it's like, this is what I'm talking about, where it's like, it's hard to understand how a person could even conceive of doing these things to another person.
Yeah, some people are just messed up. But it also shows you, like, societal constructs keep us in line a little bit. Like, you know, humans are wild animals, right? Humans do some crazy stuff. A lot of what keeps us in line, I think, is, like, social expectations. And some people just don't buy into that for some reason.
Yeah.
It's also wild that they brought her to this apartment, and Minato's parents lived there.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing.
And his brother lived there. They brought other people over to assault her. Like, so many people knew what was going on, and nobody ever said anything.
Yeah, that is insane. Another point I wanted to make is, you might wonder, what about Junko's parents? Like, weren't they worried that she was missing? What happened there? Well, they did, of course, call the cops about their daughter's disappearance, and the gang got worried about that. So they actually made Junko call her parents and tell them that she had run away and was staying with friends.
Which, yeah, they I made mean, her that call multiple times and, like, tell the same story.
I mean, I would think it would take multiple times, because that's hard to believe. Like, she's this good student, you know, she's doing fine. Like, there's no reason she would run away. Why would anyone believe that? But apparently her parents were eventually convinced.
That's tough.
And so, Paul, you mentioned that Minato's parents were around while this imprisonment was going on.
Yeah.
Why?
They would later state that they were afraid of their son because he was violent towards them.
Yeah. At first, they actually made Junko act like his girlfriend, but eventually they realized that they didn't even need to keep up with that charade anymore.
Which is wild, because it makes me think, like, even these psychotic kids were like, oh man, my parents are probably going to say something. And even these psychotic kids were surprised with, I guess they're okay with it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess we could get away with it. Probably emboldened them even more.
Yep.
And, you know, everyone's got their own story. I hate to pile on people, but my goodness, like, you're afraid of your son? There's a line, right? Like, he's imprisoning and torturing a person in his room. Like, I don't care if you're afraid, right?
Yeah.
And if you are afraid, the best thing you could probably do is have the police come and arrest him, right?
Right. I wonder what they thought would happen. Like, if they went to the police, what would keep them from doing that?
I don't know, man.
So yeah, that's definitely one of the most shocking parts of the story. The other most shocking part, I think, is the extent of the torture. And I want to, even though we put that warning at the beginning, I want to put another warning here, because we're just going to list off the things that happened to her over these 39 days. And it's horrific is in the title of this episode, and that definitely applies to this. So if you don't want to hear it, maybe skip ahead a couple minutes or something. You ready, Paul?
Ready as I'll ever be.
Junko was gang raped. We said that already. That, of course, happened multiple times over the course of this. Her genitals were shaved and burned with a match. When she tried to escape, they punched her in the face over and over, and Miyano, the leader, used a lighter to burn her ankles.
They force-fed her large amounts of water, milk, and alcohol. They made her inhale paint thinner and smoke multiple cigarettes at the same time. They repeatedly burned her legs and arms with lighter fluid, made her sleep outside in winter with little clothing.
They made her dance naked and masturbate in front of them. They tied her hands to the ceiling and used her as a punching bag. They beat her with things like golf clubs and weights and iron rods.
It's amazing that she didn't die earlier. Like, this is unbelievable.
Yeah. They put foreign objects into her, a metal rod, a bottle, a hot light bulb, even fireworks. They set off fireworks in her. They cut off a nipple with pliers. They pulled off fingernails.
Eventually, her wounds got so bad that they started rotting and smelling, which finally made the boys lose sexual interest in her. And they actually ended up going out and abducting and gang raping another woman, who they then released afterwards.
So over the course of these 39 days, Junko repeatedly begged them to kill her. On January 4th, 1989, they beat her up with their fists and an iron exercise ball. And this is when Miyano, again, that leader of the gang, poured lighter fluid on her and set her on fire. And this is when she finally passed away.
So now the boys were worried, like, oh, crap, we might get in trouble for murder. So they wrapped up her body in blankets and shoved her into a travel bag. And then they placed her in a 55-gallon drum and filled it with cement. And then on the evening of January 5th, they drove out to a vacant construction site and dumped the barrel there.
I saw it. It was actually dumped at a vacant lot near a construction site, but
okay,
just splitting hairs.
Sure. So one really odd note here is that during her captivity, Junko had apparently mentioned that she regretted not watching the last episode of Tonebow. So Miyano found the videotape of the last episode and placed it in the bag with her body. And he claimed he did this not because he pitied her, but because he didn't want her to return as a ghost and haunt him.
I did not see that detail. Wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, Paul, you mentioned that they had kidnapped and gang-raped another woman while they were keeping Junko captive, right?
Yes.
So a couple months after they disposed of her body, Miyano and Ogura were arrested for that other kidnapping and gang rape. And it feels like the police just kind of got lucky here with like a weird coincidence, right? So Miyano, the leader, when they were interviewing him, he thought that Ogura, the other guy, had already confessed about Junko. So he told the police about that crime and where to find the body. Like, this might be the only reason that the crime was even discovered, because the police are like, wait a minute, what are you even talking about?
Yeah, they were talking about another murder that unfortunately never got solved.
So the police actually went and found Junko's body on March 29th, and that's when they arrested the rest of the gang, plus Minato's mother, who is in the house, of course. I only saw the mother mentioned as arrested. I didn't see anything about the father. Did you?
No, I didn't either.
Wonder so what that's about.
Yeah, I don't know. It was also crazy that they were able to identify Junko's body by fingerprints somehow still at this point.
Huh.
They also got DNA samples off of her body that they used in the case. So great work, forensics team there.
I mean, I would think the concrete would probably help slow down the decay.
Yeah, no oxygen got in or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
In July 1990, they were all found guilty and sentenced for abduction for the purpose of sexual assault, confinement, rape, assault, murder, and abandonment of a corpse. Interestingly, they all four appealed, and were all resentenced to longer terms on their appeal.
Interesting.
So that backfired for all of them.
So what I saw is that in the end, Miano, the ringleader guy, got 20 years in prison, and the other three got between 5 and 10 years.
Yes.
That's the revised sentencing?
Yes.
Does that seem like enough to you for what they did?
That's a super difficult question.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I would say no. It doesn't. It seems light. But I think there are a lot of things here. Like, I think it really affected things that they were all juveniles in the eyes of the law, right? Yeah. That the law gives juveniles way more chance to redeem themselves at some point in their life rather than just locking them up forever.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that played a part in it. There was huge public outcry after this.
Because the public thought the sentences weren't enough, right?
Yes, exactly. So there was a lot of complaining about that. I did see that, you know, a newspaper in Japan surveyed legal professionals, and the legal professionals mostly agreed that the sentences were within precedent.
Yeah.
So those were kind of the normalish what you would get for that scenario.
What precedent could there even be for something like that, though?
I mean, that one's like especially horrific, but there probably have been cases of like minors murdering other minors or things like that in the past. And some of these guys did more bad things after they got out of prison, too.
Somehow it doesn't surprise me all that much.
Yep.
Well, the next person we're talking about is a guy named Issei Sagawa, also known as the Kobe Cannibal. This is a story I heard about a long time ago. Like, I feel like I remember this from when I was a kid.
Yeah.
And I think the thing that most fascinated me about this guy is that he was famous for being a cannibal, but was also not in prison. Like, he was just this guy living in Japan who everybody knew was a cannibal.
In a way, it was the perfect crime. He killed and ate somebody and got away with it, basically.
Yeah. And then he made his living, basically, as a celebrity because of his cannibalism. That's what blows my mind.
The craziest part of the story, maybe. It's interesting. We're about to talk about a story about a guy called the Kobe Cannibal, and I'm like, yeah, this is slightly lighter than the last one.
Yeah, right?
Isn't that something?
Yeah. So you ready to go back to the beginning?
Yeah.
So Issei Sagawa was born in Kobe in 1949 to a wealthy family. He was born prematurely and had a lot of health issues, which kind of makes me wonder, like, did that have something to do with his mental state? Did that have some impact on his mental health that might have, I don't know, gone into somehow starting to explain?
Maybe.
I don't know. Maybe. I'm just guessing.
Okay.
So his first cannibalistic desires apparently arose in first grade when he saw a male's thigh and felt like maybe he'd want to eat that. He also reported later as an adult, he said that as a child, he had committed bestiality on his dog and also fantasized about eating women.
At the age of 24, while attending Wako University in Tokyo, he followed a German woman home and broke into her place while she was sleeping. She ended up waking up and pinning him to the ground, apparently, and he got arrested for it. And
he was arrested for attempted rape.
Yeah, they all thought he was trying to rape her. He never said he was actually trying to eat her.
He said later that he had wanted to cut off a part of her butt to eat.
Yeah, it sounded like he wanted to cut off a part of her and just leave and eat it. Like, I'm not even sure if he was going to kill her or not. It seems like such a weird idea to have.
It almost sounds like he'd... Yeah, I don't know that he had a fully formed plan.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. But, so, like we said, he was from a wealthy family, and apparently what happened was his dad just gave her a bunch of money to drop the charges. And it just kind of went away. Money has a funny way of doing that sometimes.
Right. This guy should already been in jail. You know?
So a few years later, Sagawa moved to France to study at the Sorbonne, actually. And here's a chilling quote from him about his time in Paris. He said, "Almost every night I would bring a prostitute home and then try to shoot them. But for some reason, my fingers froze up and I couldn't pull the trigger." A few years after he moved to France, it's now 1981, he's 32 years old, He invited a classmate to his room, 25-year-old Dutch woman named Renee Hartveld. And while she was reading poetry at a desk, facing away from him, he shot her in the neck with a rifle.
He says he then fainted from the shock after shooting her, but then he woke up and had sex with her corpse. And after that, he started eating her. He ate various parts of her over 2 days.
He used a butcher knife to cut pieces off and then eat them. Should I list the parts?
I mean, it's almost every part. It's like he tried everything.
Her breasts, her face, butt, feet, thighs, and neck. And then whatever he didn't eat, he kept in the fridge.
And he took photographs as he was going. Like every time he cut a new piece off, he'd take another photo of the body.
Wow.
So after a couple days, her body, what was left of it, started decomposing. So he stuffed her in 2 suitcases, I think, and tried to dump them in a nearby lake that I suppose I could try to say the name of. Bois de Boulogne.
I don't have it written down, so we'll just have to go with that, I guess.
Hey, at least everyone now knows now that my French accent is even worse than my Japanese one.
You're okay, Paul.
But he was apparently caught in the act. I didn't find details on exactly what that meant, but he was later arrested by police. So maybe somebody saw something funny and called the police, and they eventually figured it out. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I wonder if he just... I'm trying to remember. I didn't see like details in my research here, but somehow I have this image in my mind from like what I heard years ago. And I feel like there was like blood on the suitcase or something. And people said it was weird. And maybe he just like sat there for a while.
Or just throwing a suitcase in a lake. People are going to be like, well, that's weird, right?
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, he was caught and arrested. But of course, again, his wealthy father stepped in and got him a real good lawyer, apparently. And after awaiting trial for 2 years, that seems excessive, waiting for trial.
His lawyers could have been trying to delay it, who knows?
Yeah. So he was eventually found legally insane and was sent to a mental hospital, still in France, right?
Yep.
So this is actually where he started to gain some celebrity. He was visited by an author who kind of interviewed him and then published his telling of the story in Japan.
Yeah. So after this publicity and popularity started spreading, the French authorities decided, let's just extradite this guy to Japan. We don't really want to deal with this anymore. So then he gets to Japan and he's taken to a hospital where he's examined and they found him to be sane, but evil. So the French had ruled him insane. Then in Japan, they ruled, no, he's not insane. He's just an awful person.
I'm kind of surprised that psychologists would call somebody evil.
Yeah, what did he say to them during that interview?
I didn't see that. I just saw that the psychologist said that he was sane.
Yeah.
I wonder what if evil was in the official reports that they wrote up.
Right. So what happens from here seems a little bit unclear. But Japanese authorities said it was impossible for them to hold him or try him again. They claimed that the French courts weren't cooperating and giving them the details that they needed. Mm-hmm. I don't really know, but basically he was allowed to just check himself out of the hospital and walk away a free man.
So what I saw is that in France, like they dropped the charges in France because he was insane, right? And then they sealed the court documents. And so they didn't have any documents that they could send to Japan. They're just like, these are sealed. You can't have these, you know? So at that point, Japan had no legal reason to detain him. Like, they just couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
It's kind of all just technicalities.
So everyone in the world knows that he did this murder, and he's just free because of the law.
Yeah. So he was set free in 1986, and from there, he basically just became a famous cannibal. And, you know, people wanted to hear what he had to say because that's just unusual and kind of fascinating, right? So he appeared as a commentator on TV. He was in a movie. He wrote books about his murder. He wrote restaurant reviews for a magazine.
That one I thought was interesting.
I kind of want to read those reviews. Like, did he really play it up and like compare it to... The fog wall
was fine, but not quite as supple as a human foot. You know,
right,
like,
right.
You know, what the hell?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just crazy to think that, like, you know, this woman's dead and her, like, family's still out there, and this guy's writing books about how he killed her and being famous and making a living off of it. That's kind of sick.
Yeah. And that's what first caught my attention about this story is just, that's so... I mean, as a kid, you know, I think I had this idea that, oh, the justice system works, you know, bad people are put away and whatever. And it just seemed unbelievable to me that, like, everybody knows what this guy did.
Yeah.
Everybody knows this guy's a cannibal, but he's just on TV and whatever. Like,
yeah, I first heard about this guy years ago. And that was the thing that really surprised me. It was like, have you heard about the Japanese cannibal? Oh, no, that's weird. No. Did you know that he's walking free and he even wrote a book about what he did? Wait, what? Like, that's what made me go, like, this is crazy. I need to look into this.
Yeah. So eventually, Sagawa had trouble finding publishers. People were starting to lose interest. They'd had enough of him.
Yeah.
So he actually went on welfare for a while. And in 2011, in a Vice interview, he said that being forced to make a living while being known as a murderer and cannibal was a terrible punishment. I thought that was interesting. I had never heard about that until I did this research. Like, that he said that having to create this public image in order to support himself made it hard to distinguish his true self from his public image.
Okay.
What do you think of that?
I have no sympathy for this guy.
It's interesting to think that, like, maybe he was...
Are you
playing
not
it
a,
up?
Are you not a freaky cannibal? I mean, that kind of seems like how you are, dude. Like, yeah.
But I could see, like, you know, being a little more extreme about it for the cameras or whatever.
Sure,
like, saying
sure.
Things. Yeah. I don't know.
Right at this point, it's like been 30 years since he did this thing, and presumably hasn't done it since.
Right.
And that's still what his whole life is about.
Yeah.
But it's because of what he did. Like, it's always going to be your life, bro. You did that to yourself.
Yeah. Here's another quote from him. He said, "It's like I have no self left. I'm just a shell. I'm acting like what people imagine me to be." So I don't know. Again, it's just that fascination. I'd be interested to hear what he thinks his
real self,
true
is.
Self
yeah,
is.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So end of the story, I guess, is he died from complications of pneumonia in Tokyo in 2022 at age 73. Anything to add, Paul?
Good riddance.
All right.
Sorry, but I hate to say that about a person's death.
I don't mind. The next crime we're going to talk about, multiple crimes actually, known as the Kobe Child Murders. These murders occurred in 1997 in the city of Kobe. The first incident wasn't actually a murder. Two schoolgirls were attacked with a hammer on February 10th, again, 1997, but they survived with injuries and were unable to identify the attacker. About a month later, on March 16th, 10-year-old Ayaka Yamashita was bludgeoned to death with a hammer. She didn't die immediately, actually. It took a week for her to succumb to her wounds. But later that same day that she was attacked, in the same neighborhood, another 9-year-old girl was attacked and stabbed several times. She survived. And around the same time, some mutilated animal corpses were apparently found in the area. A headless bird, a pawless cat. So people are starting to get worried, thinking, you know, something's not right. You know, maybe these are connected.
Yeah.
That's most probably.
It's a lot of violence happening quickly.
Yeah. So that's all pretty horrifying, but this next part is, this is what's just impossible for me to imagine, like, just the way that this unfolded. So on May 27th, 1997, the decapitated head of an 11-year-old special ed student was found in front of Tainohata Elementary School. Some articles seem to say that it was there when the students showed up to school that day. I don't think that's the case, though. It sounds like what actually happened was it was found by a janitor. Is that what you saw?
Yeah, janitor early in the morning. Like, there's no way the kids were the first ones to show up at a closed school gate. It just doesn't make sense. But I saw people trying to make that claim, too.
Yeah.
But it doesn't add up.
Right. Also, this head, his eyes had been gouged out and his mouth was slit from ear to ear. He'd been decapitated with a handsaw. Apparently they were able to determine that. And inside June's mouth, a note was found. The note said, "This is the beginning of the game. Try to stop me if you can, you stupid police. I desperately want to see people die. It is a thrill for me to commit murder. A bloody judgment is needed for my years of great bitterness." And it was signed the name Sakakibara.
Then on June 6th, a letter was sent to the newspaper Kobe Shinbun, in which Sakakibara claimed responsibility for the slaying and decapitation of June Hase, and threatened that more killings would follow. The letter was delivered in an envelope with, of course, no return address or name.
Oh, I guess I hadn't said his name before. I just started calling him June. But yeah, June Hase was the student's name.
Yeah.
So you said Sakakibara sent letters to the media, right?
Yes.
But he was also sending letters to the police.
Yeah.
He was taunting them and telling them that he was going to keep killing. Here's another quote from one of those letters. "It's only when I kill that I am liberated from the constant hatred that I suffer and that I am able to attain peace. It is only when I give pain to people that I can ease my own pain." And he went on to blame the school system, saying that it was compulsory education which formed me an invisible person.
Interesting stuff.
Yeah.
I didn't like school either, but I didn't kill anybody.
See, this is where I'm just like, the stuff in his letters, it just makes me more curious about his mental state, you know? Like, what exactly did he suffer? Like, what did he perceive was perpetrated against him in the school system or whatever?
Right. Right. He just didn't fit in or didn't have friends or he was getting bullied. I didn't see reports of exactly what was going on, but obviously he wasn't having a good time.
Yeah. So on June 28th, a suspect was arrested. He was a 14-year-old junior high student named Shinichiro Azuma, and pretty soon he confessed to everything. They also recovered his diary.
Yeah.
And found some disturbing stuff in there.
After his March 16th attack, he wrote in the diary, "I carried out sacred experiments today to confirm how fragile human beings are. I brought the hammer down when the girl turned to face me. I think I hit her a few times, but I was too excited to remember." And then the following week on March 23rd, he wrote, "This morning my mom told me, 'Poor girl, the girl attacked seems to have died. There is no sign of being caught. I thank you, Bamoi Dokishin, for this. Please continue to protect me.'" And apparently no one knows what he meant by "thank you, Bamoi Dokishin."
Yeah, like maybe this was some commie that he made up or something.
Yeah, it's another odd thing about the case.
Yeah, for sure.
So one really interesting thing is that no one seems to know how the police found him. There's been zero information about all of a sudden they just arrested him and he was the kid. No idea how they got that, but
yeah,
good police work, I guess.
So Azuma was sent to a youth reformatory. And because of the young age of the murderer, and apparently there were some other crimes committed by young people around this same time, so they actually lowered the age of criminal responsibility in Japan. They lowered it from 16 to 14 in the year 2000.
Yeah. Imagine being so horrific that the whole country is just like, "Oh man, we need to change the laws so that next time this happens, we can kill him."
Is that what it was? So that they could...
Well,
sentence him to death?
Theoretically, yeah, if you could be tried as an adult, or life in prison, or more easily punish him in a lot of different ways.
I guess. Yeah, I mean, I was kind of surprised at how soon he was released, apparently because he was below the age of criminal responsibility, right?
Yeah.
So the murders were in 1997. He was released on a provisional basis in March of 2004, and then released fully on January 1st, 2005. So he committed two murders and got less than 8 years.
Yeah.
Surprising.
And then he wrote a book about it, because why not, right?
Also surprising, yeah. He published a book in 2015 where he apparently described the murders in graphic detail, and he made a decent chunk of money from it. So I saw that that sparked some debate about whether Japan needed a Son of Sam law. Basically, that law would prevent criminals from profiting from their crimes.
Yeah.
Could apply that to Issei Sagawa, too.
Right.
He profited right. a lot off of his crimes.
Yeah.
But they still don't have a law like that in Japan, and other murderers have written memoirs since that happened. So,
yep.
Interesting. What do you think? You think they need a Son of Sam law?
Yeah. You shouldn't be able to profit from your crimes.
Seems reasonable.
I'm a free speech person, so it's like hard to say don't let them write the book, but don't let them make money from it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, you would think that there might be something to learn from hearing from these people just about how people end up like that, you know? Maybe if we learn more about their psychology, we can try to prevent that kind of thing in the future. But yeah, the profiting from it, I don't know, it's tricky because if they didn't profit from it, why would they write about it? Why would they tell anybody anything about what they were thinking?
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, maybe I know a lot of serial killers and stuff just like the attention, even if they're not getting money from it. But
yeah,
I don't know. It's a tricky situation, I guess.
Yeah. It's how they relive it, too, without having to go commit their crime again.
Mm.
By talking about it and bringing it up, they get that thrill back.
Sure.
So the next case I actually found to be the most interesting for a few reasons. So this is the case of Nevadaton, or the Sasebo slashing, it's sometimes known as.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this story is notable because, one, the very young age of the perpetrator, but also, maybe even more so, because of the extreme amount of attention it got on the internet. The internet really played, I don't know, a weird role in this whole story.
That's the interesting part to me.
Yeah, I totally get that. This is probably the first murder that was turned into a meme. Like it, we'll get to it.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the beginning. So in the early 2000s, at Okubo Elementary School in Sasebo, which is a city in Nagasaki Prefecture, there were two friends. Satomi Mitarai was 12 years old, and Natsumi Tsuji was 11 years old. And they were in the basketball club together. It sounds like, in general, they and their home lives and their relationship were pretty normal. But when Natsumi's grades started to slip, her parents made her quit basketball to focus on her schoolwork. And it sounds like that decision might have had a pretty negative impact on her mental health. It sounded like Natsumi wasn't a super social person. She didn't talk a whole lot. She was known as a bit of an otaku, a nerd, and spent a lot of time online. So, like, it sounds like this, her friend and the basketball club was kind of all she had as a social life.
Yeah, I heard it stated that she was possibly trending towards hikikomori-like tendencies.
Sure, sure.
And so losing the one thing she had in basketball probably had a really negative effect on her.
Yeah. She was also, I saw it noted that she was a fan of the Red Room urban legend. We talked about that in a past Halloween special, actually.
Yeah. She had a website, personal blog that was Red Room themed.
Oh, I didn't see that detail.
Yeah.
I saw that she was a fan of the movie Battle Royale.
Yes.
Which is a really cool movie, gotta say.
Which then, of course, got blamed for her actions later.
Yeah. Well, that was another element I thought was kind of interesting in this one, is that it seems like a lot of people blamed, you know, scary movies and video games and like...
This was in that era.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of stuff like that going on in the US too.
Yeah.
So anyway, eventually the relationship between Natsumi and her friend Satomi started to sour, and Satomi started saying mean things about Natsumi online. Cyberbullying type stuff.
On her blog, she was commenting mean things. Mm. So then on June 1st, 2004... it appears to be just another normal day at Okubo Elementary School. And then after the lunch break, Nevadaton walks back into her classroom.
This is the first time that we've called her Nevadaton. I've been calling her Natsumi.
Okay.
Just,
well, I like just the Nevadaton want to clarify. Name.
That's fine. Just wanted to clarify they're name. The same person.
Yes. She walks back into her classroom after lunch, and her clothes are covered in blood. So the teacher sees this and goes looking and quickly finds the corpse of Satomi in a nearby classroom. And Vadatan is arrested.
So apparently what had happened was that Natsumi, a.k.a. Nevadatan, we'll get to why she was called Nevadatan, but she confronted her friend Satomi in an empty classroom and told her, today you're going to die. And then she slit her throat from behind with a box cutter. There was a struggle. Natsumi made several more cuts on Satomi's arms. And when Satomi stopped moving and Natsumi thought she was dead, that's when she went back to her classroom. And then the thing that Paul said happened, where the teacher found Satomi's body. I think she was actually still breathing at that point when her body was found, but she died from blood loss before the police came. That's what I saw.
Hmm.
So yeah, Natsumi was arrested. She was taken into custody and immediately confessed. And she even kept saying that she was so sorry. Like, she seemed like immediately regretful of what she had done, but she wouldn't tell the police why she did it. So maybe she was embarrassed about her reasons, like maybe thinking, oh, I did it because I was, you know, she was saying mean things or whatever. Maybe that didn't seem like a good enough reason or something.
From what I read, it made it sound like at the start she wasn't saying anything and she refused to eat. But eventually, like the next day or later on, she mentioned that she'd been getting made fun of and questioning or making comments about her weight and calling her a goody-goody.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Drove her over the edge.
So, yeah, all of that is pretty shocking. But let's get into the way this case was received online, because that's pretty disturbing too, I think. So when this was first reported, Natsumi was referred to as Girl A to anonymize her. As I mentioned before, like they would call, you know, children that committed crimes, Girl A, Boy A, whatever.
Yeah.
But there was this picture, supposedly of her, that started circulating online, where she was wearing a sweatshirt that said Nevada on it, like from University of Nevada, right? Isn't that where it was from?
Yep.
And so people started calling her Nevadatan online. Tan is like Chan, basically. It's like a more childish pronunciation of Chan.
Yeah, which is an interesting choice, right? It kind of like...
It makes her sound cute.
Makes her sound cute, you know, like young and innocent and cute. And
yeah.
She's a murderer. Maybe there's some gap something going on there. I don't know.
And that's just the tip of the iceberg with how weird the internet got with this whole thing.
Yeah.
Because
they found her blog, which became really famous
until
it got taken down. But then it got mirrored a bunch of places. They made little chibi drawings of her that they would post in chat rooms.
The fan art is what really gets me. Like, if you look up Nevadatan online, you find all this stuff where she's like drawn in an anime style, like a really cutesy style, but then she's covered in blood or like holding a bloody knife.
Yeah,
people were idolizing her for some reason, and this gets me too. She even became a really popular costume for people to wear at anime conventions.
I saw a bunch of pictures of cosplay.
Yeah. I mean, I would get it if she was a character in an anime, but like to dress up as a real person, murderer.
To be an edgy teenager again.
Yeah.
And think that's a good idea.
I don't know. I guess people do stuff. I mean, people, I feel like it's less common these days. I feel like there's just more social awareness maybe, but like you'd hear about people dressing up like Hitler for Halloween or whatever, you know?
I could see someone like being Jack the Ripper, but that's at least some like distance to it, you know?
I feel like historical figures are a little more acceptable, at least.
Someone shows up and they're like, I'm this famous serial killer. And then you're like doing the math in your head. Wait, did that serial killer get caught? This is a guy in costume, right?
Yeah.
I'm the son of Sam. You're dressing as the son of Sam, right?
Well, now I'm thinking like Dahmer. Are there people that dress up like Dahmer for Halloween or something? I could
Someone probably has.
Yeah.
Should we talk about her sentencing?
Yeah.
I mean, being so young, 11 years old.
So the crime was committed in 2004, right?
Mm-hmm.
I saw that she was sent to a reformatory in Tochigi Prefecture, but was released in 2008.
Yeah, she originally sentenced for 2 years, and after an evaluation after 2 years, it was extended by 2 more years, and then she was released in 2008.
I wonder what she's up to these days.
I saw that she was eventually apparently diagnosed with Asperger's.
I heard that too.
Communication issues and obsessive behaviors. But it's also like her name was never officially released. So like, how do we even know this type of stuff?
Yeah.
I don't know. But that obviously doesn't excuse being a murderer.
Right. So this case raised another debate about the age of criminal responsibility.
Yeah, I don't think it got lowered again, but there was serious talk about lowering it even further.
Right. I don't think they technically lowered the age.
But she was so young, like 11, that you're going to lower it to 11? Like, oh my goodness, that's young.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a crazy one. I mean, they're all crazy ones.
This makes me more glad I'm not a politician. You know, imagine there's just like this horrific murder by a child and then everyone's screaming at you like, throw the child in jail for the rest of their lives. Change, like, everyone's going to be mad at you no matter what you do.
Yeah. Sometimes there's no right decision. You know?
Yeah. Right. There's no right decision for everyone. Well, we got one more case. And this one's way more lighthearted.
Yeah. Let's lift the mood a little bit. There's no murder in this one.
It's still crime. But no,
but it's a fun crime.
Yeah, as long as you're not the one getting stolen from.
Yeah. Well, it's an entertaining crime at the very least,
yes,
I think.
Yes, absolutely.
We're talking about the Ninja of Heisei. So in Osaka, between March 2009 and June 2017, there was a ninja who committed over 250 B&Es. That's breaking and entering.
That's a lot.
Yeah. He stole around 30 million yen, mostly in cash. That's around a quarter million American dollars.
Yeah.
Now, you might say that real ninjas haven't been around since the Edo period, right, Paul?
Yeah.
But this guy did a pretty good job of playing the part, I'd say.
Yeah, he sure did.
He dressed up like a ninja. He scaled walls. He would squeeze through tight spaces. He would plan escape routes. All that ninja stuff.
Yep. He was very meticulous with his planning, and he got away with a heck of a lot of these.
I mean, 250, apparently, around that.
Yeah. Eventually, he made a mistake, though, and took off his mask within sight of a security camera. And from there, police identified him as 74-year-old Mitsuaki Tanigawa.
Like, once they figured out who he was, they started following him, and they caught him red-handed when he went into an abandoned building, and then when he came back out, he was dressed like a ninja. We gotcha.
Yeah, they were surprised at his age for sure. But we all were. When he's running on the top of walls and stuff.
I hope I'm that agile at that age.
So then he was quoted as saying, "If I were younger, I wouldn't have been caught. I'll quit now as I'm 74 and old enough."
Yeah. I also love his reason for doing it. He just said that he hated working.
Yeah, he's like, "I didn't want to work anymore." So he just stole. It's funny, but I absolutely hate getting stolen from.
Yeah, if
nothing
I was one of the victims, I would
upset
be super
that, like,
right. It's such people, a violation,
right?
You know?
People so lazy, they don't want to go work, so they're just going to steal my hard work. I hate that. I hate that so much.
I agree, but it's also a really entertaining story.
It is. I honestly, I've been so mad about all my bikes that have been stolen. Uh-huh. But if I had like security cam footage of like an elderly ninja stealing my bike, I'd feel a little bit less bad about it, you know?
Right, right. Yeah.
I'd at least gain some entertainment out of the loss.
Would you go to his court case and just shake his hand and be like, "Well played, old man"?
No, no. Not that happy about it. But I wouldn't go testify against him.
All right.
That's all we got.
That's it. I hope you had a ton of fun hearing about all this grisly stuff.
Me too.
Well, before we go, we should thank our Shogun-level patrons, Wesley C., Nicholas McKibben, Kevin Harris, Brady K., Jack, Michael Morris, David Imani, Darwin Perrier, Ethan Teague, Yasmin, Jason, Katarina and Ellery, Susan, Tori, Shaked Rosenthal, Tina Anderson, Alexa Gonzalez, Pamela Arola. Thank you all so much for your support.
Thank you. So, we are going to be in Japan.
Uh-huh.
So the next episode is going to be another Folktales episode.
Oh, it is.
Because we can't record an episode while we're in Japan.
You didn't wait for me to ask you what the next episode was.
I mean, I'm excited.
Proactive. Wow.
Yeah. So then after that, we'll be back on our regular season schedule.
Yeah.
And that episode will be our first trip recap from the trip that we're taking right now.
I was going to say I'm excited to record that episode, and it will be fun, but I will also be sad that
you're going to be all depressed.
Not in Japan anymore, yeah.
I remember last time, like, I was still riding the high for like a week or two. You know, like, I was just in Japan. I feel great. Day we got back, you were like, I'm not in Japan anymore.
I know. I'm going to be posting all those stories on Instagram where, like, you know, it's the one where Stewie, he gets in bed and he just starts, like, softly sobbing to himself.
Yeah.
That'll be me. I just wanted to point out, those folktale episodes, those are bonus episodes. Those aren't even, like, part of the 10 episodes of this season. So you really get 12 episodes.
Just exactly.
Wanted to, you know, yes. Mention that.
Yes. Great point.
Anyway.
Just to keep the feed going, give you something if you so choose.
Yeah. Well, if you'd like to find us online, if you'd like to reach out to us, we're on Instagram. We're at SJP Podcast. You can also visit our website, sightseeingjapanpodcast.com. Bunch of good info there. There's a list of all our episodes. It's searchable. You can find whatever you're interested in hearing about.
Check out the travel tips section.
Yeah,
especially if you're taking a trip. Look at the packing list.
For sure. Well, thanks for listening. We hope to see some of you very soon in Japan. And we'll see you next time.